Venoms are toxic substances that are injected by some means from one animal to another, either for defensive reasons or for offensive reasons. They may be used to drive predators away, or they may be tools that predators use to weaken or kill their prey. Welcome to Iconocast, the science and advocacy podcast. I am Mike Harbrick, and Greg Layden is my co-host. Our guest for this, the eighth episode, is Christy Wilcox, Ph.D. Christy is a science writer who blogs for Discover Magazine's website. Her new book on venoms is a detailed and adventurous examination of so many of the aspects of venoms. How do venoms work? How have they evolved? What is the effect that they have had on primate and human adaptation? Is it possible that our color vision adapted as a means of being able to see venomous snakes? The book is Venomous: How Earth's Deadliest Creatures Mastered Biochemistry. And Christy is cool enough and generous enough with her time to talk to Iconocast about the coolest and creepiest aspects of the science of venom.
One of the reasons we wanted to have you on our podcast, we wanted to have you on our podcast anyway, but then I heard about your book.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this would be a really good time. Your book is not out yet, right?
Not yet. August 9th.
Okay. I've got an uncorrected proof, and nice. I read it. And just so people know, your book is called Venomous: How Earth's Deadliest Creatures Mastered Biochemistry. And it's really good. I read a lot of science books, and one of the things that makes it hard for me sometimes to read science books, because I am a scientist, is that I go through page after page after page, and I'm not really learning anything new, especially when I'm reading about human evolution. I mean, to me, a human evolution book is the most boring thing in the world to read. Not only are they always wrong, in my personal opinion, but it's just stuff you know. But I found your book to be a page-turner. I learned something new every paragraph. It's amazing. I was a little bit embarrassed because I was telling my wife about some of the stuff today, and she's going, yeah, I know, because she's a biology teacher, and she already knew about some of the stuff. But this is a really interesting book. It's really well-written, really engaging, written in a very accessible language, and I think it's a great piece of work. You should be congratulated on it. I hope it does well, and it should do well. Let me start off this way. I actually thought I should know more about this than I did, because I spent something close to 3 years living in a highly venomous environment. And when I was doing field work in the Congo, when I was actually in the field, as opposed to in town getting my Land Rover fixed, I was probably envenomated about once every 3 days by something.
Oh, my.
Usually it was a caterpillar, because there are these venomous caterpillars that are everywhere. And when you're walking through the forest on a given day, you'll run into a number of them. And when that would happen, you know, I would sometimes feel a sting at the location, like a little undifferentiated sting. And then very quickly, I would feel the lymph node nearest that spot, like under my armpit, if it was in my arm, get painful and start to swell a little bit. And sometimes shooting pains between where the caterpillar brushed against my skin and the lymph node. And then maybe other lymph nodes would do the same thing, but usually just that one. And then that would be that way for a while. And sometimes even if you get stung like that every day a couple times, you basically walk around with slightly painful, swollen lymph nodes all the time. Can you tell us what the physiology is of what's happening when that – what happened to me when that occurred?
Oh, goodness. Well, so caterpillar venoms are very interesting and somewhat understudied, except for the really, really dangerous ones.
Which I don't think these were, because I would be dead.
Yeah, no, you would probably know if this was, a Linomia species, for example. But one of the things that caterpillar venoms are trying to do is sort of prevent predation, right? So it's helpful to have a venom that is painful, for one, if you're trying to stop something from eating you. And maybe even that lasts a little while, so that it has that sort of signal going to the predator that hopefully will learn, if I touch this, it's going to hurt for a while.
And I would have liked to learn, but I still couldn't avoid, running into them. So what's happening at the molecular level there?
So it depends on the caterpillar species, but most likely some of the stuff that's happening is your immune system is obviously getting activated. So these venomous compounds can activate neurons, activate certain blood pathophysiological mechanisms. I'm not exactly sure, depending on this caterpillar species. I mean, most of the caterpillars tend to be pretty hemotoxic, so they tend to have a lot of sort of activities on blood cells and be pretty immunogenic, but it depends on the species.
Yeah, I got the impression when I was reading your book that I was being, I was brushing against immunogenic caterpillars because there was like my immune system was doing something very sudden. And by the way, since we're at near the beginning here, can you just give us, and I'm probably going to use this word wrong because I just grew up using the word wrong, but can you give us the distinction between, it's like that old joke, you go up to a guy in a park bench and there's a dog sitting there and you say, does your dog bite? And he says, no. And then you pet the dog bites you. And you say, I thought you said your dog didn't bite. And he says, well, that's not my dog. You know, by this, there are no or very few, if any, poisonous snakes anywhere, right? Lots of venomous snakes, but no poisonous snakes. Can you, give us a lowdown in that terminology?
Yeah. So you got a couple of terms, right? There's toxic or toxin, which just means does damage, basically. I mean, a toxin is something that does damage to our bodies in very low doses. Toxic is the activity of a toxin or potentially of things that are not toxins. So you can think about like water. If you drank 30 gallons of it in one sitting, it would have toxic effects on your body. But it is not a toxin because it doesn't cause harm in low doses. Okay. Then you have sort of the two categories. You've got venomous and poisonous or venoms and poisons. And those two split based on essentially how they get into you. Poisons are anything that causes harm when ingested, inhaled, or absorbed. So gases tend to be poisonous. Those little frogs that you touch, the poison dart frogs, if you touch them and you get the poison into you, that's a poison because it goes in through the skin. Now, venoms are far more entertaining, in my opinion, because they require some variety of injury. And essentially, it's an animal that is actively trying to hurt you, not passively trying to hurt you, right? And they can be used for offense or defense. We tend to think of them as sort of the offense. We tend to think of snakes and spiders and scorpions. But there are also lots of defensively venomous animals like fish, where they still have an injuring mechanism. They have like a spine that they stab you with, for example.
One of the interesting fish you talk about is actually the mammal, platypus, which is the fish-like mammal.
And I love the platypus.
Now that's the only I can't remember now. Is that the only venomous mammal? No, it's not.
It's not the only venomous mammal. There are several venomous mammals. It is the only in a few categories. It's the only animal that neither uses their venom. I mean, their venom is primarily for masculine combat. So this is only the males are venomous. They have spurs that look kind of like teeth. Like they're huge, like pointed spurs on their ankles, and they use it for fighting over females.
Right. I now remember that there is 9 orders of mammals that have venomous animals in them, right? Or so, or venomous species.
Something around. There's a bunch. There is a primate,
right?
Slow loris, which may actually be the 4 slow loris species, depending on who you ask. You've got venomous bats. In the vampire bats are venomous. You've got some venomous shrew-like creatures, selenodons, I think, and a couple of the shrews too. Yeah, so you've got quite a variety of venomous mammals, although not nearly as much variety as you have in, say, reptiles or, you know, some of the insects.
Is it the bats? Are those vampire bats the ones that inject like an anesthetizing agent into your skin so that they can suck your blood without you really getting alarmed or panicking? Is that the venomous bat, or are there other ones?
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. All of the vampiric animals, so anything that drinks blood essentially as its main staple nutrient, is venomous. At least all the ones I can think of. So even mosquitoes, we tend to sort of question, well, venomous really? But when mosquitoes inject, they inject a toxin technically. They inject anticoagulants, they inject anti-inflammatory substances. So they're injecting venom when they bite.
Now that's interesting because this is something that's really interesting about the argument you make in this book about the relationship between venom and evolution and so on. Because when you talk about malaria, you talk about mosquitoes, being the most deadly venomous creature because so many people die of malaria and other mosquito carrying diseases. When I first read that, I thought, nah, that's going too far because those are not venomous bites that are killing you. And it's kind of an extreme argument. But by the time I was done with your book, I completely agreed with it because when you look at what organisms do with their venom, it isn't just that they poke at you and hurt you. They do all kinds of things that go, in many cases, that go beyond that. And it's extremely complicated. So I first thought you're going to get trolled on the mosquito argument. people are going to say, no, it's not mosquitoes. But really, if you could get rid of the venomous capacities of mosquitoes, you would reduce malaria. Because every time a mosquito bit you or drilled its proboscis into you, you would feel it. And you would swat it. And they would just not be as successful. It's how they managed to be successful.
Right. And even more directly, when you look at something like malaria, where those parasites and where the viruses like Zika, where they're actually hiding in the animal is in that salivary gland where the venom is being produced. And so if it did not inject these compounds, if it only stuck its nose in there and sucked it out the blood, right? No injection of any kind, then you would never have transmission of these diseases.
Exactly. And you also talk elsewhere about the idea that some animals are venomous because they have a bacterium that they give you, and then it makes you – that produces a toxicity, and that turns out that that's not really what happens.
Right. So there was a long-standing belief that Komodo dragons in particular, although I think they've suggested it for some other animals, but Komodo dragons in particular had a bacterial bite, essentially. And the idea was that their mouths were so disgusting and fetid with this rotting flesh that they've eaten that they were culturing highly septicemic bacteria. And when they bit an animal, like a water buffalo, they injected this bacteria essentially or got this bacteria into the wound through their biting action, and then the animal would die several days later from the bacterial infection or be weakened enough from the bacterial infection that the dragons could take it down. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that this came about was because people were seeing dragons feeding on these large animals that they shouldn't theoretically be able to feed on. But what they've realized since, and particularly Brian Fry at the University of Queensland showed, is that they actually have pretty clean mouths, and it's not, the bacteria isn't coming from the dragons. It's coming from the watering holes that are on these, you know, low islands in the Komodo region. And so they don't have access to nice clean water. So these, you know, animals are going and wading in this poop filled, basically watering holes and getting ill. And the dragons have learned to capitalize on this. So they've learned that they follow their prey that they've bitten, even if it's gotten away, and they can find the animal later and attack when it is weakened.
One of the interesting things about venoms is that they're so diverse and there's so many of them. And you repeatedly go back to this idea in your book about the importance of venom and venom-related strategies in coevolution. And I mean, we now think in terms of evolution that everything is coevolution. You can't look at anything without reference to the evolution of related features in other animals in the same ecological system as the one you're looking at. And that really works with venom more than almost anything, because almost always venom is, there's always something being bitten or being repelled or being preyed upon or something. So there's all those evolutionary arms races that are out there. When they involve venom, they're pretty obvious, but there's interesting patterns. So let me start off with this question. Many snakes are venomous and many snakes are not. So venomous properties in snakes must have evolved either multiple times or once a great deal of time ago and then been lost in many snakes. As an example of the phylogeny of venom, how does it work? Can you just give us a brief description of what we think about the historical phylogenetic evolution of venomous snakes?
Sure. So there's actually, it's somewhat of a heated debate amongst some venom scientists, but so far, at least I'm on the side of there was one essentially evolution of venom. I mean, it's hard to say one evolution of venom because obviously multiple genes were duplicated and co-opted for use, et cetera. So there were multiple events within that one evolution. But the idea is that there was one evolution of venom. And the reason that we know this is because if you look at the phylogenies, we can see the exact same toxins spread across not just snakes, but actually some closely related lizards like the Komodo dragons. And the idea, they call this the toxicophora, the clade that they think is venomous. And so then the question is, what happened, right? So you do have, you know, you have boa constrictors, you have all these other snakes that are not venomous. What happened to them? Why aren't they venomous? What keeps coming up is this idea of evolutionary costs. So venom and toxic chemicals are very expensive. They're expensive because you have to produce them, right? And you're using them up. So they're expensive in a just literally production sort of capacity. And they're expensive because your own body has to be adjusted to handle them. So whether that means you have to have some sort of sequestering mechanism, or you have to have the ability to fight off your own venom toxins in your body. A lot of toxins target sort of universal systems, especially if you're talking about a snake venom toxin that's targeting other lizards or other reptiles, right? Mm-hmm. Physiologically, they have a lot of similarities. So if this toxin can hit a lizard, there's no reason that it couldn't necessarily hit a snake as well. And so there's a lot of mechanisms and a lot of cost associated with not harming yourself while you're trying to use the venom. Mm-hmm. And so what we find is that it takes a lot of energy to replenish venom, to keep venom stores going, as compared to other lineages. And so if you have any reason why you don't need venom, so say you switch to eating eggs, and they've seen this in sea snakes. Sea snakes that eat fish are venomous. There's a couple of species that go after things that are easier to catch.
And they don't have venom.
And the snakes in particular that go after things like eggs have less toxic venom or lose their venom altogether. And so what we think might have happened is that some of the constricting snakes became really good at constricting. They became larger. They became, you know, muscle was cheaper than venom. Mm-hmm. And so they catch animals using other mechanisms instead of using their venom.
Interesting. Does this help explain one of the other mysteries you talk about in your book, which is how is it that so many of the, I know this is an open question, but how is it that so many of the prey species of venomous predators, like the things that snakes eat, most don't have resistance to the venoms?
Right. So it's an interesting sort of cost benefit, right? So if you're a squirrel, there's a lot of things that want to eat you, you know? Venomous snakes are one of them, but there's also all these birds and all these, you know, other mammalian predators potentially. And so you're trying to fight off a variety of strategies. And resistance to venoms can be expensive. And so if your odds are that you're going to get killed by an owl or a falcon before you're going to get killed by a snake, you're going to be, you know, adapting strategies to deal with those. Those are going to be the primary strategies that you're going to be looking for. And so you might, you know, be faster, more vigilant, alarm calls, that kind of thing. Whereas if your main predator is a venomous animal, then you might adapt a way of dealing with that animal in a sort of arms race kind of context.
The other thing that's interesting I just realized is that there also are relatively few poisonous mammals, mammals that are not good tasting or that you don't want to eat because they have repellent flavor. There are a few. There's one antelope, the water buck, is, you know, if you're eating into its skin, there's a period where you are eating some really bad, icky stuff. It turns out it doesn't stop. Well, they are preyed upon by lions less often than they should be based upon their abundance. It doesn't stop them, but it makes them less palatable. And again, that's, again, probably a cost thing. It's just so costly to do it. But I wonder also if it's a life history thing as well. Mammals evolve from very fast growing, short-lived organisms just several tens of millions of years ago. And so any investment in that kind of long-term thing is not something that would have been there in the primordial species so much as it might be in other species. But then there's that category of mammals that does have resistance.
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you want to talk about them? Like the mongooses and their relatives.
Right. So you have a lot of animals like opossums, mongooses, honey badgers, perhaps most infamously, that are very resistant or, quote, immune to venom. Whether or not they're really immune is a little bit of a nitpicking, but, you know, you could theoretically dose them with enough venom to kill them usually. Mm-hmm. But they're at least strongly resistant. And the reason we think that that is because they're able to sort of employ this food niche that is otherwise unavailable to other animals, and that's the venomous snakes. I mean, if you have a bunch of cobras running around, cobras are meaty. You know, they've got a lot of muscle to them. They'd be a pretty tasty meal if you can deal with that whole venom thing, right? And so that these animals are able to actually exploit a resource, a potential food resource that is unavailable to the vast majority of other animals, even other similarly sized predators, because they've developed these resistance mechanisms.
One of the things that it works throughout your book that you have reference to in the very beginning and then quite a bit later on is this whole human story. And I think it starts with pre-human. It's not specifically a human story, but rather primate story. The famous snake detection theory, which I think is pretty reasonably respected for a theory about the evolution of primates, most of which are controversial all the time. There is this idea, you know, it's very hard to make an argument for detailed behaviors being so born in that they're genetically determined in your neural system. But we do have some pretty automatic reactions to the world around us. And it appears that snakes might be one of those things, that we have a very deeply built in fear of, or at least let's say highly canalized reaction to snakes. We're good at seeing them. But how good we are really varies. I'll tell you a story from the Congo. When I first went out there, the Americans that were there that I replaced told me that, you know, obviously I asked about snakes and they said, no, there's really no snakes. We don't really see snakes. There's hardly any snakes. Everybody always said there'd be snakes, but we don't see any snakes. And then I brought them to the airport and I came back and I sat down with for the first time. Well, after a few days of getting some more language under my belt, I was talking to the local pygmies and I said, you know, those guys said there were no snakes around here. And they just started laughing. And they said, yeah, that's because that one individual was so afraid of snakes that we just told her that there were no snakes. And for one year, these two people were there and hardly ever saw a snake. So I said, so there are snakes. And they said, yeah, for example, come here. So we walked over to this bush that was just on the outside edge of our compound. And the guy pointed and said, see that snake? And I looked and I didn't see a snake. He said, right there. Can't you see it? And I looked again and I couldn't see it. I said, I don't see it. He said, hold on a second. He takes out his arrow, which is an arrow designed for killing monkeys. So it's just a stick with a sharp point. And he puts it on his bow and he shoots it into the bush. And this arrow goes through about three parts of the body of a green tree snake, pinning it to the bush. And I didn't know at the time that that was a famous boomslang. That's the other word for green tree snake is a boomslang. It's a highly toxic or a highly venomous snake. And he says, see, they're everywhere. So I think there's got to be a cultural the innate fear of snakes has been kind of demonstrated in the various experiments. But the innate ability to see them, that's going to be dependent also on the environment you grow up in and what you're used to seeing and what you're used to looking at, I think.
Right.
But anyway, how does the snake detection theory shape our evolutionary past?
Well, so the idea of it is that at some point in primate history, and there's some evidence to show when that was, but at some point in primate history, one of the major predators of primates were snakes. And these were venomous snakes. And they were such a problem or such an issue that any sort of adaptation or mechanism that made it so that you were able to avoid being eaten by a snake was a huge evolutionary advantage, right? And this is how we think natural selection works, that if you have anything that makes it so that, you know, you survive and reproduce more than somebody else, then you're going to potentially pass that on. And so the idea was that the threat of snake predation actually helped shape especially our visual systems. And so the idea that we're looking for snakes, we're able to see snakes and trying to discern the shape of a serpent inside a patterned background or colors. So our color vision, our ability to see patterns, our ability to see all of these things might have been driven, at least in part, by detecting snakes and trying to avoid being eaten by snakes.
I'm going to add two pieces of evidence to support that. One is among primates that are known to use alarm calls that are specific, for example, vervet monkeys, which have a few alarm calls. So they can learn alarm calls. And one group in Amboseli Park, they basically came up with a brand new alarm call that meant anthropologists for when the anthropologists showed up. It was distinct from the, you know, other things because they weren't threats, basically. But they
right.
have a call that appears to be aerial predator, meaning basically a monkey-eating eagle. And they have a call that appears to indicate leopards, and they have a call that appears to indicate snakes. So that they've got that. The other thing is, in much of Eastern and Central Africa, in rural regions where people get bitten by snakes, so outside the cities in the rural areas where people get bitten by snakes, the most common snake bite is the mamba, and the most common context for that is in a tree. And it's people who are going up into trees, either harvesting some kind of fruit or palm wine or something like that. And they go up into the tree and they encounter so in other words, humans, which aren't normally in trees, when we do get bit by a snake in some context, it's because we go back into the trees and there's a snake there.
Right. And it's been shown in lots of different primate species, including us and our closest relatives, that snakes do stand out, that even basically infant humans react to an image of a video of a snake more quickly than they react to other things, and they react to the fear response. So it seems to be actually coded in our DNA to be afraid of snakes.
I think also the internet has proven with all of the cat videos, I think cats also react to squiggly things like snakes also. There's a whole bunch of videos of people making snaky shapes near a cat, and they jump up in the air, and it's very funny.
Exactly. Yet,
you know, they're not living around snakes. Although, so, again, going back to the Ituri in the Congo, we had a cat, a series of cats. There would only be the one cat, and then it would mate with a wild cat and have babies. Two times in a row, all the babies were killed by a snake. I think the mother might have eaten the snake or killed it. So the baby wasn't ever... I think maybe the cat brought a snake back for the babies to play with and eat or something like that. It was like some kind of evolutionary maladaptation because it was a half-domestic cat. But it was interesting because they died of – it was pretty clear that they were dying of snake bites, and they all died every time. But anyway, that's a sad story. But the human thing has another feature to this, which is – I don't know. I mean you imply certain things in your – book, and I don't know if you quite go as far as you might have wanted to or you might not even want to now in discussing these things, but you talk about generally people become very interested. We all know that people get very interested in snakes or people who, and tarantulas and other venomous things, and they collect them. People get interested in these and they study them. You yourself have a fascination that may be not entirely healthy because sometimes you get stung by something with venomous things. But there's this group of people who are called, is it pronounced SIers?
Yes, the self-immunizers.
Okay. Self-immunizers. People who, for various reasons, which are not completely clear that are being articulated in a completely straightforward way, like to get themselves bit by snakes or more commonly inject venom into themselves. And then there's another group of people, apparently a rising and increasing number of people, mainly in South Asia, who are using, I think, snake venom or snake bites as a recreational drug.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a very different groups of people, but in some ways they're doing something similar and having similar results.
So with the self-immunizers, I mean, the main goal, at least of most of the people that I've talked to who self-immunize, is self-protection. So when you keep a venomous snake as a pet, essentially, there's always a risk of being bitten. And for many of these snakes, if you're keeping something that's exotic, for example, that risk goes up because not only do you have the risk of being bitten, but you have the risk that your local hospital doesn't have the right antivenom. Somewhere in the middle of Georgia isn't going to have, you know, cobra antivenom, for example, because they don't have cobras there. So the idea behind what most self-immunizers are trying to do is use the same principles that we use with vaccines or with developing antivenoms, which is that your body, your adaptive immune system, can create antibodies to toxins and various things that you're introduced into your body. So with vaccines, you know, we for example, have a dead vaccine where we kill it so that it can't be active, and then we inject that into a person and try to create an immune response so that if that person is then infected with that virus later on in life, their immune response is automatic and they actually are able to fight it off. So self-immunizers are trying to do that with venom. But of course, because it's something that is introduced in a high dose and highly toxic, unlike a virus, which is usually introduced in a low dose and very, at first, lowly toxic, they have to be constantly injecting themselves with venom. So they have to keep those antibody levels circulating in their bodies at really, really high levels. And there's limited science on how well humans do this as opposed to other animals. But if you look at, you know, Google SI or self-immunizing videos, you can see that there are people out there who at least appear to be resistant to bites from some of the world's deadliest snakes, snakes like black mambas, which you would normally never expect. I mean, black mambas have basically 100% kill rate if you don't get antivenom in the wild. Mm-hmm. And so there are people that are taking bites from these animals and successfully surviving them, at least in part potentially due to an immune response to the venom. Now, of course, this is something that is very, very, very contentious in the venom community because it is dangerous. There's no doubt about it, no question about it. I mean, you are injecting yourself with a deadly toxin, and there's not a whole lot of scientific research and evidence on how much you should do, how often you should do it. I mean, these people are really exploring. So there's a high risk of, you know, overdosing essentially on snake venom or on a bite, right? Or delaying medical attention too long. Mm-hmm. So if you think you're immune and you take a bite and you just wait, and then you get to a point where your body is too far gone by the time you actually do receive anti-venom or you do receive medical attention. But they really have this amazingly interesting sense of pride in what they're doing. Believe they're going to potentially change a lot about sort of venom science and venom medicine, that they're going to hit breakthrough that has been otherwise kept at bay because scientists are unwilling to experiment with humans.
I almost get the impression that, yeah, that it isn't just a sense of pride, but a sense of defiance it's like when you have, you know, physicists will tell you that they're always being contacted by people who have a better theory than Einstein, but no one will listen to them. And they really can't explain that the speed of light varies or something like that. And the Galileo syndrome, like, I am Galileo. I have come up with something no one believes and everyone is persecuting me. It almost seems like there's a bit of that going on. And at the same time, they really are, like, you know, I think about Washburn and Hillary who started off, you know, conquering a mountain, you know, Everest, but ended up becoming major geographers who changed the way that we map things and doing science, because they were explorers. And they seem to be both of those things at once. And it's a little bit hard to know if we're looking at something that is, and then on top of that, they feel better. They feel different, right? It's almost like they feel that they found, but they're not saying it overtly, a fountain of youth. Steve Ludwin or someone who said, if I'm 100 years old, I will have proven myself correct. When someone
Phil
else said
Hoff.
That. Yeah. Yep. You know, that's a fountain of youth idea. And that's not just, I don't want to die when my pet cobra bites me. That's something a little bit more intense than that, I think.
Yeah. And there is, I mean, the idea of sort of exercising the immune system or challenging the immune system repeatedly. I mean, it's certainly not restricted to venoms. I mean, there are people who believe that, you know, if you take small amounts of a toxin every day,
sure,
you know, like drinking lead or something, but, you know, in a low enough dose that you've, you know, you become sort of superhuman because you're able to deal with toxins better. It's an interesting hypothesis, and it's one that's extremely difficult to really test because, one, good luck getting the ethics board approval for that one, you know, and also just that humans in our daily lives, I mean, there's so many variables affecting things like our health status, from our genetics to, you know, the air we breathe, the plants around us, the everything. So trying to really tease apart whether or not this one activity affects sort of longevity in a small sample size, in a small number of people who aren't doing it all the same way. I mean, it's a scientific nightmare.
Well, I know I'd want to be in the control group, that's for sure.
But yeah, so separately of the SIRs, you mentioned the recreational use of venom. I personally found that to be the most interesting chapter to write and the most interesting thing that I stumbled across in my research. Completely taken aback.
Yeah, it is actually that. I think that, to me, the snake detection theory as a kind of a starting point, the SI activities, and then the recent and growing use of venom, snake venom, as a recreational drug, make themselves a kind of a separate story that's more about humans almost than about venom.
Right.
But I think that could almost be your next book. But you shouldn't get too much into this.
The whole recreational use thing, it just completely, the first one I read, I was just sort of like, wait. So there was the sort of street drugs, and I was like, well, okay, but, you know, you talk about ingesting something versus being injected with it. And those two are very different, you know, absorption profiles, for example. There's a reason that there are certain drugs, like insulin, for example, that you have to inject and you can't as easily just take a pill. And so with snake venoms, we're talking about usually large proteins that get destroyed by gut enzymes and acids. So you wouldn't expect any activity, really, if you were to drink. And there have been people who have at least claimed, anyway, throughout history, to drink snake venoms to show how immune they are to snakes, which then scientists are like, well, okay, but it probably wouldn't hurt you if you drink it. Try injecting it, then show me, you know?
Right.
So there's that first. And then there was the people, I stumbled across these several several medical papers, each with several cases, of people saying that they were bitten by snakes intentionally with the effects of getting high. And I just blew my mind, the idea of people, especially the snakes they were talking about. I mean, most often, if the species was named, it was a cobra. I mean, we're talking some of the deadliest snakes in the world. And these people are like, oh, yeah, let me, you know, get bit under the tongue by a little one and paying money to get it happen.
And paying money. Yeah. And cobras, little cobras, their poison is just the same as the adult cobra, right?
Yeah. I mean, so it depends on the species. You might see some sort of oncogenetic shifts in venom composition, but baby cobras definitely have venom. They have less of it. So, I mean, there's that.
Yeah, I want, yeah. So you could go and you wouldn't want a whole cobra, a whole adult cobra, maybe 2.5 baby cobras worth of dose to start out with.
Yeah, I mean, baby cobras certainly have potent venom. I wouldn't want to test whether or not it was quite enough to kill me.
And I still would have a hard problem thinking about somebody at Woodstock shouting out, don't get bit by the brown cobra. Don't get bit by the brown cobra.
Right, it's a bad batch of cobras.
Yeah.
By the way, baby cobras are really cute because they look exactly like the adult ones, and they even stick their head up and fan their thing out just like adults do. Have you ever seen them? At least in some species, they're kind of – it's like a miniaturized – it's a miniaturized cobra. I want to get back to some of the evolutionary questions for just a moment. You talk about venom in many different groups of animals, in snails and fish and – mammals and snakes and so on, reptiles. And if we compare that to something like vision, you know, the process of converting photons into neural signals is only possible, as far as life on this planet goes anyway, in a very small number of ways. There's only one gene family that produces a really important protein that lets that happen. So it tends to have evolved only minimal number of times and then diversified from there. But venom seems to have evolved many times from completely independently. Do you have a count? I mean, how many times has venomousness emerged in animal life forms on this planet? Do you have any idea? Is it 1,000, 120?
Oh, goodness. It's a ton. I mean, it just came out a paper last week that showed that venom likely developed 18 times in fish alone.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're talking a large number of different independent origins. And part of that is because you have, I mean, our definition of venom is somewhat broad, I guess you would say. It's just sort of anything toxic that's injected, which means that you're talking about a lot of different protein families that can contribute. Although what's really fascinating is that you still have it generally limited. The main toxins in these venoms are generally limited to a couple dozen families of proteins. I mean, they're much smaller than you'd expect for the number of times that venom is.
Yeah, so are most of them sodium and potassium channel disruptors?
So there's those. There's several different types of essentially ion channel disruptors. But there's also pore-forming toxins have evolved a number of times. Anything that inhibits or accelerates the clotting cascade.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
You've got all sorts of these, you know, thrombin, prothrombin-related molecules. Yeah, I mean, so there's a lot of cutting enzymes, proteases of various varieties, for example, lipases of various varieties. So it's really fascinating how the different families and then the different activities that they do.
It's almost like if you go into a kitchen, you'll find all kinds of things that cut and slice and dice just mm-hmm. to make just to cook your dinner, and they're all benign uses and everything's fine. And then you ask yourself the question, how many of the things in his kitchen that are not that closely related to each other can I use, you know, to kill my cat or murder my neighbor?
Right.
And, you know, and it's actually all of them. You know, anything sharp. And, you know, for example, just as ion channel disruptors are, you know, ion channels are fundamental to basic cell function mm-hmm. and in particular neurons, but everything. And you mentioned the clotting cascade and so on. These are all basic biological functions that all animals are doing. And venoms seem to basically get into those key points in normal physiology and disrupt something. And
right. There,
of all the many ways you could do that, there's probably a limited number that are extremely easy to find a protein to do.
Right.
So lots of venoms can evolve, and they can kind of evolve in parallel because of that.
Right. And what's interesting is, so a lot of the, certain venomous groups do exactly that. They take something, especially take something that is used normally to do that activity. So there are points in our bodies or in times or whatever when you want to shut down a neuron. You want to turn it off, right, at least temporarily. And then they take that protein or that peptide and make it into a toxin that they can push out into another animal.
You talk about an example of a fish that, or no, a conefish that is a thousands of species of conefish and they're venomous.
Cone snails, yeah.
Cone snails. And some of which eat fish. At least one example of a case where it is expected that a defensive venom has been changed through evolution into a predatory venom.
Yep. So yeah, the cone snails are really one of the more fascinating groups because in some ways they defy the rest of the toxic groups. They have largely these little peptides that they use, which are generally neurotoxic, but they do a vast diversity in each individual snail. I mean, whereas you might have one or two main toxins in a lot of, you know, these, or lethal toxins in a lot of these bigger animals, these teeny little cone snails, which, I mean, the biggest one gets to be, what, 6 inches long? So we're talking small animals, maybe 8 inches. They have thousands. I mean, there was one of them that they actually found over 3,000 different peptides in this one teeny little snail. And these genes for these toxins, which are called conotoxins in general, they mutate incredibly quickly and they duplicate incredibly quickly. So they're outpacing any other sort of molecular evolution or DNA evolution that we've found to date. And they use these originally, we think, defensively. And so these were toxins that were meant to kill fish, not kill them, but to stun them or to scare them that were trying to be eaten. And then they have sort of captured that ability and made it deadlier, and now they can kill fish. And it's one of the few first cases where we've really been able to sort of detail how an offensive venom evolved. Mm-hmm. And which is really fascinating and interesting, because when you look at something like snakes, you would think it would be really obvious, right? But we actually don't have a very good understanding of how reptiles or that reptilian lineage went from being a non-venomous animal to being a venomous animal. I mean, there's some theories that they were sort of co-opting antimicrobials in their venom or in their saliva and turning it into venom. But then there are people that say, no, that doesn't really make sense. It doesn't seem to fit. The compounds they're using aren't really antimicrobial in nature. So we don't really have a good idea of where that transition occurred. Whereas in the cone snails, we have this interesting and potentially, you know, different system where we say, okay, yeah, we can see how these were evolving for defense and then became offensive.
Okay, it's also interesting that the peptides in the conefish, they evolve so diversely and quickly, and it's a matter of gene duplication. So you have genes that are duplicating mm-hmm. at a high rate. But the systems that they're going after also, in physiology, also are typically diverse because of gene duplication. So the yep. same genes that make various sodium channels, it's the same exact gene at some primordial level, of which there are, I think you point out in your book, the possible number is something like 24 million possible sodium or ion channels, if they all existed, all the different possible combinations, some really large number. So it's kind of a parallel that the thing that's being attacked is in that sense of gene duplication being the primary source of diversity. I think Mike had a question for you about something.
Yeah.
Right. Now, your book's not coming out until August 9th, but if some people wanted to get a taste of your writing style, and especially in relation to venoms and so forth, you did a series of posts related to Discovery Channel's series on venom hunters. And I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about that and address some of the safety issues both for animals and people on that you discovered while you were writing that series.
Right. So Venom Hunters was a Discovery Channel show. They ended up canceling it after only one season, which some people are very, very happy about. Mm-hmm. But it was a Discovery Channel show that at least claimed they were going to show how people collect venoms for medical research and anti-venom production. And in initial principle, that sounds like a great idea. And a lot of people I know, particularly in the venom community, were really excited about the idea of a show looking at the venom industry and how venoms, unfortunately, Authentic Entertainment and Discovery Channel decided what the show was going to say before actually consulting any of these experts. And so they kept going out and approaching leaks and, you know, selling the venom and making all this money off of it. And people that actually do produce venom for anti-venom research or for medical research said, well, actually, we have a captive colony of 2,000 snakes. We milk them daily. Mm-hmm. Well, not all 2,000, but we milk them daily, you know, mm-hmm. in our lab in a sterile environment, et cetera. So you're welcome to come and film us. And it didn't end up being that way. And so they ended up putting out this show, which basically sells the idea that you can go out into the wilderness, catch a copperhead, milk its venom, and sell it for tons of money, and this could be a very viable business for anyone to do. They literally, the first episode is titled Liquid Gold. That's not true. Let's just start there. Most of snakes that you could possibly catch are not going to be worth a lick when it comes to selling the venom. I mean, there are places with stockpiles of kilograms of, you know, copperhead and rattlesnake venoms that are just waiting for somebody to buy them. They certainly have plenty. So the idea that this is this lucrative business is false. The idea that these venoms that are caught, you know, from a snake in the wild and then the snake is released are being used for anti-venom production is false. I mean, I actually contacted BTG, which is the major producer of Crofab, the only anti-venom for every rattlesnake species in North America.
Mm-hmm.
And they flat out said, nope, we produce the venom ourselves, or we have, you know, a couple of people that we contract to do it, but they have long-term captive snake colonies. We don't use that type of venom. We don't use it from, and they specifically even said, we've never used any venom from Discovery Channel or the Venom Hunters program. So there was this big setup of this idea that you can go out and collect venom and make money off of it. And some people in the venom industry are particularly worried that people are going to try to do this now. And they've been seeing people who run serpentariums, for example, are getting emails and calls from lots of people saying, hey, you know, I've got tons of copperheads in my backyard. How much would you pay for the venom? And they're like, none. We got tons of copperheads in our serpentarium. We're not going to pay you for this, and don't touch them, please. I mean, these snakes, in the U.S., we are lucky in the sense that the vast majority of us have access to medical care. We have access to anti-venom. That is not true for certain other places in the world, like India and Africa, where you could go hours, if not days, before receiving, you know, proper medical care for a snake bite. And most of the snakes in the U.S. don't kill people. I mean, we have less than a dozen deaths a year here. But that said, if lots more people go out and get themselves bit, you're going to see a rise in morbidity and mortality. And so people are very worried that this program has essentially created this fantasy job for people who like reptiles, where they can go out and catch snakes, and that these people won't know how to catch snakes. And so they'll be putting themselves at risk for bites. And then even worse, also that they will be mishandling the snakes, which will put the snakes in danger. So you're going to be potentially harming both sides of that equation.
Mm-hmm. And even in Australia, they had kind of film out there, and they were supposedly hunting some snakes that would have been, because it was winter, July and August in the Antipodes is their winter, so the snakes would not have even been out for them to hunt. So they staged, it appears, these snakes coming out, and they caught them and supposedly captured their and milked their venom from that. But another issue too is apparently that the collection of the venom in the wild is not necessarily very tightly controlled like you'd want to have in a lab. So there's always a possibility that they could introduce unwanted bacteria or other things in the way that they were collecting them. Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, field collection of venom is not really what you want when you're talking about a medical application. It can potentially be enough, you know, if you're studying venom variation and you just want to get an idea of what proteins are in the venom, you might be able to get away with something like that. But if you're talking about, you know, using it to try to treat something or to isolate compounds for treating something, I mean, the more contaminants you have, the more likely you are to get thrown off or have errors in your experiments. I mean, certainly bacteria produce a variety of bioactive compounds. If you had bacteria getting into your venom, then you could see an effect potentially like in a cell line and think you found something, and then it turns out to be, you know, some protein from E. coli or whatever mm-hmm. else.
Yeah. Now, I think we should get back for a moment. You know, I had expressed some incredulity that I had had, that I had had some incredulity in reading about the role of the mosquito as a venomous mm-hmm. strategy in relation to malaria, until I got through your book and realized that that was actually the least complicated example of of an interesting venom strategy. There is actually a wasp, which you mention, that is named after the Dementors of the Harry Potter series. And I don't know, you don't say a lot about the wasp. It may not be that interesting, but you talk about the jewel wasp, which is another related wasp, that uses venom that contains peptides that are interactive with, sort of act as neurotransmitters in a sense. And it does more than that. It could you just tell us a story of how a jeweled wasp has a baby jeweled wasp? Just to scare the crap out of us. It's kind of the big finale of this show.
I love telling this story, particularly around Halloween.
Yeah.
Because we like talking about zombies and all of that. And so what the jeweled wasp does, just to describe the event. So jeweled wasps use cockroaches as essentially baby wasp incubators and then food sources. So what they'll do is they'll find a cockroach, and the first time the female wasps, and all, by the way, all stinging wasps, bees, et cetera, are female, because the stinging system is actually a modified ovipositor or egg-laying device, so the males don't have them. So anyway, female wasp finds her target cockroach, and she stabs him in the chest, essentially, if you can imagine where that is. And that makes it so the cockroach can't move. So it's a short-acting but very potent neurotransmitter that acts to open up chloride channels, which basically dampen neuron signaling. So it paralyzes for a brief amount of time the legs of the cockroach. And while he's paralyzed, or she, I guess, the wasp then carefully injects venom into the cockroach's brain. And this is where the really fascinating part of this comes in, because she actually targets two tiny little, if you think about the size of a cockroach head, and then think about how tiny the brain is inside of that. She targets certain areas inside of that brain. And scientists have done really neat experiments where they've actually taken out those teeny tiny sections of the brain. And the wasp essentially sits there probing around with her stinger trying to find them. Until she eventually gives up because she can't. But I mean, so she's really, really aiming the venom in a very specific way.
Almost like brain surgery.
Yeah, very, very precisely. And then she injects venom into the cockroach's brain. And what happens after about half an hour, you've got the legs are free again. That's completely worn off, but the cockroach has completely changed its behavior. So they become less skittish, less afraid of anything. You can even go up to them and actually like rub a leg, you know, touch them, and they won't run. And I don't know if you've ever tried to catch a cockroach in your mm-hmm. house, but trust me, you go anywhere near them and they're usually bolting. So this is a complete change in behavior. And what's effectively happened is the cockroach has lost all will to move and to flee. It's lost its fear, essentially.
But it could. It just doesn't want to.
It's somewhat akin to a rush of serotonin. And so this now happy cockroach, I guess you could say, or at least I like to think they're happy based on what's going to happen. It makes me feel better about it. She'll take that cockroach and she will lead it by an antenna. So they are capable of moving. They're not paralyzed. They just don't, unless they're being pulled. So she takes and she leads it into a burrow and she lays an egg attached to its leg. And what that egg will do is it'll develop, it'll hatch into a larva, and that larva needs to eat. And the cockroach will actually sit there and not move, not struggle, not flee in any way, not try to get out, while that little larva eats it alive from the inside out.
Oh, boy.
So it'll burrow in, and then it will start with the least necessary organs to keep that cockroach alive for the longest amount of time possible while it eats it. And then eventually the larva will be happy, it'll be sated, it'll cocoon, and it'll emerge as a beautiful new wasp.
There's one step in there I think you skipped. Isn't there a point where the jewel wasp actually takes a drink off the cockroach?
Yeah, so right before she leads it, what she'll often do, or seems to do, is break the antenna and will actually drink the cockroach's essentially blood, the hemolymph. And it's unclear why she does this. Some think that it may just be nutrition. You know, she's put a lot of work into stabbing it and needs a little bit more nutrition. Some people actually think they're detecting whether or not their venom has had the right effect. That there may be something in the blood that there hasn't been as well studied as the brain stabbing yet, but.
It's clearly something else. It's some kind of satanic ceremony. it's just part of the ceremony. It's like a Viking drinking the blood of his enemy out of a horn or something.
I wrote a little short story actually. Was it last Halloween? Where I tried to put myself in the mind of a cockroach being attacked by a jewel wasp and what that would feel like.
Oh, wasps themselves are an entirely other thing, and this is just the intersection between wasps, which are all crazy stories like that. Like, every wasp has a crazy story like that, and venom, and most of the venom stories are pretty crazy, too.
Well, yeah,
and there's an intersection between those two things.
There's over 100,000 species of wasps that essentially do this to some other animal. I mean, they're called parasitoid wasps, because as adults, they're free-living, and they feed on their own, but when they're young, they need to feed off of another animal, so they're parasites. They call them parasitoids. And there are, I mean, there's ones that do it to all different kinds of animals. And it's really interesting because a lot of these are being considered or looked at for potential pest control. Because you have an animal that has evolved to essentially kill exactly one other animal.
Right.
And so if you could find the right parasitoid wasp for any given pest, and theoretically get them in the right density for any given pest, you could kill that pest off, or at least manage it pretty well in an area.
Yeah, there's been cases where an invasive species of insect people have tried to control it by bringing – it didn't bring its wasp with it when it invaded a new continent, and then they've introduced a wasp to try to undo that. Well, that – I don't think we have time for much else because we've
– It's been about an hour, yeah.
Yeah, and there's a lot more in this book. And that you do elsewhere. I mean, not everything you do is in this book. And then what's in this book is a lot. It's a very rich book. And really, again, I just want to emphasize it's very, very readable. And people should get it in August, right, when it comes out?
August 9th is when it releases. You can pre-order it.
We will have a link on our website to pre-order that book.
Fantastic.
Both Kindle and in hardcover.
Yep.
So whatever format that you need. And then also
an audiobook is coming soon.
Oh, cool. Have you already done the reading for that, or do you have somebody else do it?
There's someone else doing the reading, but yeah, they're working on it.
Get Frank Langella. No, he's not alive anymore. Somebody does a good Dracula voice would be good.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question? Are you going to have the same illustrations, or are you going to have additional illustrations in the final copy?
I think it's the same illustrations. I wish we had room for more illustrations, more pictures. I will have a website with lots of pictures because I took a lot of pictures.
Yeah, just to be, I know. And I would say this would be a great book to have like a little central section with like nine leaves, pages of, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Things, you know.
I know. Maybe the paperback version.
Yeah. No, but it's really good.
There is actually a venomous plant. One of the stinging nettles meets the criteria.
Greg Layden and I wish to thank Christy Wilcox for being our guest on episode 8 of Iconocast. Please go to our website, iconocast.com, and follow the link to purchase Christy's book. This is Mike Hobrick, and thank you for listening and sharing this episode.